This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. This is Chapter 58. It seemed to me that the turn of the century had to bring a new spiritual light to humankind. It seemed that a climax had been reached in excluding spirit from human thought and activity. A complete change in human evolution seemed an absolute necessity. There were many who expressed similar opinions, but they failed to realize that people would try to turn their attention toward a real existent spiritual realm in the same way they approached nature through the senses. They attempted only a sudden change in the subjective spiritual disposition of the soul. The discovery of a new and real objective world was beyond the range of human vision at that time. My feelings about the future and my impressions of present surroundings caused me to look again and again by spiritual means into the development of the 19th century. With the era of Goethe and Hegel, the ability to receive and understand mental representations of the spiritual world disappeared from human thinking. It was thought that such images should no longer, quote-unquote, deceive knowledge, and they were banished to the realms of mere belief and mystical experiences. I considered Hegel to be the greatest thinker of modern times. But he was only a thinker. The spiritual world for him was within thought. Nevertheless, it was just because I so thoroughly admired the way he carved out every thought that I sensed his lack of feeling for the world of spirit, which to me was directly perceptible. It is a world that can be discovered behind thinking. Once thinking has been intensified into a definite experience whose body is thinking, within which the soul receives universal spirit into itself. Since Hegel presents all spirit as thinking, to me he was one who brought the final glimpse of the ancient spiritual light into an era when spirit is veiled in darkness for human cognition. All this confronted me, whether I looked into the spiritual world or surveyed the century that was coming to a close in the physical world. But then Max Stirner appeared in that century, a person I could not follow into the spiritual world. Hegel was completely a person of thought. He worked to develop a kind of thinking that increasingly deepened itself and at the same time broadened to wider horizons. By deepening and broadening thinking, it would ultimately unite with the thinking of cosmic spirit, which encompasses the whole cosmos. On the other hand, Stirner believed that everything produced by human effort originated in the individual's personal will. To him, human achievement as a whole was simply the accumulation of separate individual human efforts. My primary concern, especially at that time, was to guard against any one-sidedness. Because I had delved so deeply into Hegelian philosophy, I experienced it as though it were my own. Consequently, I now had to inwardly immerse myself in this completely opposing philosophy. And indeed, this one-sidedness that posited the human individual simply as a being of will had to become the counterbalance for the Hegelian extreme of seeing cosmic spirit endowed merely with knowledge. I would not have let this flow into my writings or lectures if my experience of the contrast between these two views had resulted only from my own soul experience of my personal development. I have always adhered to this rule in regard to such soul experiences. But this particular contrast between Hegel and Stirner was a part of the 19th century, which spoke through them. It is true, after all, that it is not a question of the effect philosophers have on their own times. One could certainly mention Hegel's powerful influences, but that is not the most important aspect. In the meaning of their thoughts, philosophers reveal the zeitgeist, just as a thermometer reveals the temperature of a room. The subconscious life of the age becomes conscious in its philosophers. Consequently, the 19th century existed within the two extreme impulses expressed by Hegel and Stirner. On the one hand, impersonal thinking inclined toward contemplating the world, in which human beings with their inner creative forces have no part. On the other hand, there was a completely personal will, with little feeling for mutually harmonious cooperation. Indeed, there was talk about all kinds of, quote, social ideals, unquote, but they had no power to influence reality. Life was shaped increasingly by all that arises when individual impulses of will act side by side. Hegel wanted the ideal of morality to assume objective form in society, whereas Stirner felt that the influence of such harmony in human life only misleads the individual, the unique personality. In many ways, my study of Stirner was influenced by my friendship with the important Stirner scholar and editor J. H. Mackey. Earlier, I had met this thoroughly likable person in Weimar through Gabriela Reuter. He had been occupied with part of my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom, the part that deals with ethical individualism, part two, quote-unquote, practice. He saw a certain harmony between my own social views and my exposition. My interest in Mackey was first aroused by my personal impression of him. He carried the quote-unquote world within him. Everything he said and did bore the stamp of world experience. He had lived for some time in England and America. All of this was steeped in unlimited kindness. I developed a great affection for him. When Mackey settled in Berlin in 1898, we developed a wonderful friendship. Unfortunately, this friendship too was destroyed by life, specifically through my public representation of anthroposophy. In the case of Mackey, I may describe only my own personal impression, which remains the same today, of his work and its effect upon me. I am aware that he would speak very differently of it. That man deeply hated any form of force ruling force in society. He considered forceful intervention in social administration the worst possible offense. He considered, quote, communist anarchism, unquote, despicable as a social ideology, because it tries to improve human conditions through force. In his desire to fight that ideology and the agitation it stirred up, Mackey made the unfortunate choice of naming his own social ideas with the same term his opponents used, but with a different adjective. He called it individualistic anarchism, which was intended to mean the very opposite of what was then called anarchism. Of course, this led the public to form distorted judgments of Mackey's ideas. His views were shared by the American Benjamin R. Tucker, whom I met when he came to visit Mackey in Berlin. Mackey is also a poetic advocate of his view of life. He wrote a novel titled The Anarchists, which I read after becoming acquainted with the author. It is a noble work, based on his deep-seated confidence in human individuality. The book is a penetrating and exceptionally vivid description of the social conditions of the poorest among the poor, but it also portrays how those people will find the way out of their world of misery to better conditions by turning to the good forces in human nature and developing them so that they work socially in the free community of human beings without the need to resort to force. Mackey had the noble confidence that the people themselves could create a harmonious social order. But he considered it a possibility for the distant future, once humankind has accomplished the necessary inner transformation on a spiritual path. For that reason, his immediate demands called for sufficiently advanced individuals to propagate the idea of such a spiritual path. Consequently, his social ideal wished to work only through spiritual means. Mackey's view of life also found expression in poems. His friends found them somewhat didactic and theoretical and thus inartistic. I loved them. Destiny now turned my experience with Mackey and Stirner in such a way that there I also had to delve into a world of thought that became a spiritual test for me. My ethical individualism was a pure inner experience of the human being. To make it the basis of a political view could not be further from my intention when I elaborated the concept. But at the time, about 1898, my soul, along with pure ethical individualism, was dragged down into a kind of abyss. From being a pure human inner experience, it was made external. The esoteric was to be diverted into the exoteric. But when I was able to present my experience of the spiritual world at the beginning of the new century in writings such as titled Mystics After Modernism and titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, ethical individualism once more took its proper place after the test. Yet here, too, the course of the test was such that the attempt to externalize ethical individualism played no part in full consciousness. It took place directly below full consciousness, and just because of that proximity, it was able to flow into the expressions I used when I spoke about the social affairs of the final years of the preceding century. But again, here it is necessary to place certain statements that appear all too radical against others to gain a true picture. Those who are able to see into the world of spirit find that their own being is always externalized when they have to express their opinions and views outwardly. They do not enter the spiritual world in abstractions, but in living perceptions. Neither does nature, which after all is the physical image of spirit, present the world with opinions and views, but reveals its forms and processes of growth and becoming. My inner experience at the time was an inner churning that brought all my soul forces into waves and waves. Outwardly, my private life had become entirely satisfactory, because the Oinecke family had moved to Berlin, and I was able to live with them with the best of care, after having experienced for a while the complete misery of living alone. A short while later, my friendship with Frau Oinecke was transformed into a civil marriage. Let this be enough about this private relationship. I do not wish to relate private matters in this account of my life, except when they are connected in some way with my spiritual development. And my life with the Oinecke family afforded me an undisturbed basis for a life that was extremely eventful, both inwardly and outwardly. As for the rest, a person's private life does not belong to the public. It is of no concern to them, and my spiritual development is completely independent of all private relationships. I realized that it would have taken exactly the same course, even if my private life had been entirely different. Amid all the turbulence of life in those days, there was constant concern about the survival of the review. If material means had been at my disposal, the circulation of this weekly paper could have been enlarged, despite all my difficulties. But the periodical could not thrive on the very small circulation it had when I took over, since it could pay only minimal fees and provide me with almost none of the bare necessities of life, and nothing could be done to make it known. While I was editor, the review was a constant concern to me. The end of chapter 58. Chapter 59. During this difficult time of my life, the directors of the Workers' Educational School in Berlin came to me and asked me to teach history and public speaking in their school. Initially, the Institute's socialist connection was of no interest to me. I visualized an interesting task of teaching mature working men and women, since there were not many young people among the students. I made it clear to the directors that if I took over the teaching, I would present history according to my own views of human evolution, not as interpreted by the Marxists, as was now customary in social democratic circles. They nevertheless wanted me to give the courses. Having made this condition, it did not matter to me that the college was based on a social democratic ideology by the elder Liebknecht. To me, it consisted of men and women of the proletariat. The fact that the majority of them were socialists was none of my business. The mental outlook of my quote-unquote students, however, was my business. I had to find a completely different way of expressing myself than I had become used to until then. To make myself understood to some degree, I had to find my way into their forms of the concepts and judgments. These came from two sides. First, from life itself. These people knew physical work and its results. They had no idea, however, about the spiritual powers that guide humanity through history. That was why they so quickly accepted Marxism and its, quote, materialistic interpretation of history, unquote. Marxism maintained that the only driving forces in historical development are economic and material, that is, forces produced through physical work. Quote, spiritual factors, unquote, are considered to be a kind of byproduct of the material economy, a mere ideology. Added to this was the fact that for a long time the workers had felt a growing eagerness for a scientific education. But this could be satisfied only in the popular materialistic literature on science. It was the only literature that could accommodate the workers' concepts and opinions. Anything not materialistic was written so that the workers could not possibly understand it. Consequently, an inexpressibly tragic situation arose. Whereas the growing proletariat had an intense craving for knowledge, it could be satisfied only through the grossest form of materialism. It must be remembered that there are partial truths in the materialistic ideas of economy, and they are absorbed by the workers through Marxism as, quote, materialistic history, unquote. It is precisely these partial truths that are easily understood by the workers. Had I merely ignored them and taught history from an idealistic perspective, the workers would have sensed that what I said did not agree with the partial truths they already knew. Consequently, I began with a fact that was comprehensible to my listeners. I showed why it makes no sense to say, as Karl Marx does, that economic forces dominated history prior to the 16th century. I also showed economics did not assume a form as understood in Marxist terms until the 16th century, and that this process climaxed in the 19th century. Thus I was able to speak quite factually about the spiritual ideals active in the preceding epochs of history, and I could show that more recently those impulses weakened in the face of the material and economic forces. In this way, the workers received ideas about knowledge capacities and the religious, artistic, and moral forces in history, and they ceased to regard them as merely ideological. It would have been useless to enter a controversy over materialism. I had to allow idealism to arise from materialism. In the course on public speaking, of course, little could be done in this way. I would begin a class by discussing the formal principles of lecturing and speaking, and then the pupils practiced making speeches. Of course, they brought up the materialistic ideas familiar to them. At first, the workers, quote-unquote leaders, paid no attention whatever to the school, so I was perfectly free. But matters became more difficult when I had to teach natural science in addition to history. In this area, it was especially difficult to present the facts and go beyond the materialistic concepts spread by those who wished to popularize them. Nevertheless, I did my best in this direction, and it happened that through natural science, my teaching activity expanded among the workers. Numerous trade unions invited me to lecture on natural science. Especially in demand was instruction on Haeckel's title, Riddle of the Universe, which was creating a stir at the time. A third of the book dealt directly with biology, and there I saw a short, precise summary of the relationships among living organisms. I was convinced that this line of thinking can lead humankind in general to recognize the spirit, and I considered this to be true for the workers as well. Consequently, I related my lectures to that portion of the book, and I said often enough that the rest should be considered worthless, that it should be cut out and destroyed. At the celebration of the Gutenberg Jubilee, I was entrusted with a festival address to 7,000 typesetters and printers at a Berlin circus. Thus my way of speaking to the workers met with approval. Destiny again brought me to a situation in life in which I had to submerge myself completely. I saw how the individual soul in this working-class population slumbered and dreamed, and how a kind of group soul held them all in a common grip, entwining their imagination, judgment, and bearing. It must not be imagined, however, that there was no life left in the individual soul. In this way, I was able to look deeply into the souls of my quote-unquote students and those of working people in general. This supported me in the difficult task I had taken on. The workers' attitude toward Marxism was not yet what it would become 2 decades later. At that time, Marxism was like a gospel of economics that they processed with great attention. Later, the proletariat became as though possessed by it. The proletarian consciousness at that time consisted of feelings that appeared to be evoked by mass suggestion. One often heard it said that a time would come when the world will again develop spiritual interests, but the proletariat must first be saved in a purely economic way. I found that my lectures brought much that was good for their souls. They accepted even what contradicted materialism and Marxist interpretations of history. Later, when the quote-unquote leaders realized how I worked, they attacked it. In a gathering of my students, one of the minor leaders had this to say, quote, "In the proletarian movement, we do not want freedom. We want reasonable compulsion." Unquote. They intended to drive me out of the school, despite the will of my students. Matters were gradually made so difficult for me that a short while after I began my anthroposophic activity, I dropped it. I have the impression that if more unbiased individuals had taken an interest in the workers' movement in those days, and if the proletariat had encountered real understanding, that movement would have developed very differently. But the people were left to life in their own class, while the others lived within theirs. The various classes viewed one another merely theoretically. The problem of wages was discussed when required by strikes and so on, and all sorts of welfare institutions were established that were highly commendable. But the consideration of these world-shaking issues within a spiritual context was lacking. Yet nothing else could have removed the destructive element from this movement. This was the time when the upper classes had lost their sense of community, a time when egoism was spreading in fierce, unbridled competition. That time was already preparing the world catastrophe that would occur in the second decade of the 20th century. Furthermore, in its own way, the proletariat developed a feeling of community as proletarian class consciousness. The proletariat participated in the culture developed by the upper classes only to the degree that it justified proletarian class consciousness. Gradually there ceased to be any bridge at all between the various classes. Thus, in connection with the title Review, I had gone completely into the nature of the bourgeoisie and into the proletarian through my activities with the workers. I had a rich field indeed for experiencing and understanding the driving forces of the time. From the spiritual world, a new light was ready to break into human evolution through the intellectual accomplishments of the final third of the 19th century. But materialistic explanations of those achievements had caused spiritual sleep in humankind that prevented an inkling, let alone a conscious awareness of this. This is how an era arrived that through its very existence should have developed toward spirit, but it denied its own essential nature. That time began to make the impossibility of life a reality. The end of chapter 59. Chapter 60. At this point, I would like to quote several passages from my articles in the March 1898 issue of the title Journal of Dramatic Art. It had become a supplement to the title Review in early 1898. Referring to the art of public speaking, I said, quote, "In learning the art of public speaking, a person is left to oneself and to chance as in no other area of the arts. Today, with the form our public life has taken, almost everyone is often called on to speak publicly. Raising ordinary speech to a work of art is rare. We lack almost all feeling for the beauty of speech, and still more for speech that has character. No one would consider it appropriate to allow a person with no knowledge of singing to write about a singer's performance. In relation to dramatic art, even less is required. It is becoming increasingly rare to meet anyone who can judge whether a poem is read properly. To speak artistically is usually considered to be misplaced idealism. This situation would not have arisen if people were more conscious of the possibility of cultivating speech artistically." End quote. In a sense, what was in my mind then was not realized until much later in the Anthroposophical Society. Marie von Sievers, Marie Steiner, was deeply enthusiastic about the art of speech and devoted herself, above all, to true artistic speech. She made it possible to offer courses in speech formation and dramatic art, which had the effect of lifting it to the level of an art. Because many people look for contradictions in my evolution, I say this here, to show that certain ideals tend to develop over the course of my life. Part of that period involved my friendship with the poet Ludwig Jakubowski, who died at an early age. He was a tragic person who suffered deeply the destiny of being a Jew. He managed an office directed by a liberal deputy who headed the Association for, quote, the Prevention of Anti-Semitism, unquote, and published its periodical. Jakubowski was overburdened with this work. It is work that each day reopened a burning wound because it confronted his soul daily with mental images of the feeling against his people, which caused him great suffering. At the same time, he launched into rich activity in the subject of folklore. He collected everything he could lay hands on for a book he was writing on the development of folklore since primordial times. Some of his articles, written from his rich store of knowledge on the subject, are very interesting. They were written in the materialistic spirit of the time. If Jakubowski had lived longer, however, he would have no doubt opened up to a more spiritual direction in his research. Ludwig Jakubowski, his poetry radiates from his activities. His ideas, though not entirely original, expressed a depth of human feeling and rich, strong experience of the soul. He called his lyrical poems titled Luminous Days. Indeed, those poems, when the mood inspired him, were like sunny days in his tragic life. He also wrote novels. Quote, Werther the Jew depicts Jakubowski's own tragic life, titled Loki, Story of a God, is a work born from German mythology. The soulfulness speaking from that novel beautifully reflects the author's deep love of folk mythology. The amount of work Jakubowski accomplished in such diverse areas is astonishing. Despite this, he found time to enjoy a social life and managed to associate with a great number of people. Furthermore, he edited a monthly paper titled The Society, which meant that he was enormously overburdened with work. He was consumed with life, and he ardently desired to give artistic form to its meaning. He also established a society called The Coming Ones, German Die Kommenden, which consisted of writers, artists, scientists, and those interested in the arts. Meetings were held once a week at which poets read from their poetry. There were lectures on all kinds of subjects, and the evening would finish with an informal gathering. Ludwig Jakubowski was the center of this continually growing circle. Everybody loved this amiable personality, which was full of ideas, and he even developed a refined and sensitive humor within the group. Sudden death tore him from all those activities when he was only 30. He died of meningitis owing to his never-ceasing and strenuous efforts. The task fell to me to deliver the funeral address for my friend and also to edit his literary estate. The poet Marie Stoner, a friend of Jakubowski, wrote a beautiful memorial to him in a book of contributions by his friends. His whole life evoked admiration. His inner tragedy, his aspirations away from this to his, quote, luminous days, unquote, and his devotion to an eventful life. The memory of our friendship remains constantly alive in my heart, and I recall our brief association with affectionate, deep devotion to my friend. Another friend at the time was Marta Asmus. She was inclined toward philosophy, but with a strong tendency toward materialism. This was greatly softened, however, because she lived so intensely with the memory of her brother Paul Asmus, who had died young and been a committed idealist. Like a philosophical hermit during the last third of the 19th century, he experienced anew the idealistic philosophy of the Hegelian era. He wrote a booklet on the human I capital and another on Indo-Germanic religions. Both were written in an Hegelian style, but completely original in meaning. Though he had died quite some time before, I came to know this interesting person intimately through his sister Marta Asmus. This person seemed to me like a meteor blazing forth the spiritually inclined philosophy of the beginning of that century against the philosophy at the end of the century. For a while, I had significant though less intimate relationships with Bruno Wille and Wilhelm Bölscher, the Friedrich Hageners. Wille is the author of title Philosophy, The Pure Means of Liberation. The title is reminiscent of title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, but it is concerned with very different matters. His significant book, titled Revelations of the Juniper Tree, brought Villa wide renown. It is a philosophical work written with an excellent sense of nature and permeated with the conviction that spirit speaks from all material existence. Wilhelm Bölscher is well known through his many works on popular science, very much in demand by broad circles of readers. This group of people was interested in establishing an independent college, and I was drawn into that venture. I was to teach history. Bruno Wille taught philosophy, Bölscher taught natural science, and Theodor Kapstein, a free-thinking theologian, taught religion. A second establishment with which they were concerned was the Giordano Bruno Union. This was intended mainly for those with a philosophical interest directed toward an idealistic, monistic worldview. This view stressed that there were not two world principles, matter and spirit, but that the unifying principle of spirit creates all existence. Bruno Wille inaugurated the group with a brilliant lecture based on Goethe saying, quote, "There is no matter without spirit," unquote. Unfortunately, a slight misunderstanding arose between Bruno Wille and myself after the lecture. At the end of his lecture, I stated that Goethe, a long time after he first coined those beautiful words, supplemented them in a significant way when he recognized that the effective spiritual activity of existence, polarity and intensification, are the concrete forms of spirit, and that only this amplification gives the full meaning to the general aphorism. This remark was taken as a criticism of Wille's lecture, though I fully acknowledged its significance. I met real opposition from the leading members of the Giordano Bruno Union, however, when I gave a lecture on monism myself. In the lecture I emphasized that the crudely dualistic concept of, quote, matter and spirit, unquote, is, in fact, a recent phenomenon, and that the contrast between spirit and nature, opposed by the Giordano Bruno Union, had also arisen only within the last two centuries. I pointed out how scholastic monism compares to this dualism. Although scholasticism maintains that a part of existence is inaccessible to human knowledge, that is, available only to faith, it nevertheless presents a world system that shows a uniform monistic constitution, from the Godhead of the spiritual world all the way down to the smallest detail of nature. In this way, I placed scholasticism on a higher level than Kantianism. With this lecture, I caused extraordinary excitement. People thought that I was paving the way for Catholicism to enter the Union. Of the leaders, only Wolfgang Kirchbach and Marta Asmus stood by me. The rest were unable to imagine what my intention was with this, quote, unrecognizable scholasticism, unquote. In any event, they were convinced that I was well suited to bring a great deal of confusion into the Giordano Union. The reason I recall this lecture is that I gave it during the period when I was a, quote, materialist, unquote, that is, according to opinions expressed later on. Nevertheless, at that time it was thought by many that this materialist wanted to revive medieval scholasticism. Despite all this, later on I was able to present at the Giordano Bruno Union my foundational anthroposophic lecture, which became the point of departure for my anthroposophic work. Somewhat difficult decisions must be made when speaking publicly about spiritual knowledge, such as that contained in anthroposophy. The nature of such decisions is best described through certain historical facts. A completely different early human soul constitution corresponded to the cognition of the spiritual world, which existed until the beginning of modernism, sometime around the 14th century. But that knowledge was different from anthroposophic knowledge, which corresponds to our present mode of cognition. After that point, humankind, at first, could no longer produce spiritual knowledge. Ancient knowledge, originally received by human souls in the form of images, was handed down and preserved in symbolic form. In very early times, this ancient knowledge was cultivated only within the mysteries, imparted only to those who had matured enough through training to receive it, that is, the initiates. It was not supposed to be made available publicly, because there is easily a tendency to handle it in an unworthy way. In later times, those who gained insight into this ancient knowledge preserved that custom. they cultivated it in small groups of people who had been prepared to receive it. This has been the situation that continued until the present day. Among those I have met, I will mention one who made this demand in relation to spiritual knowledge. He belonged to the group I described that gathered around Frau Lang in Vienna. He was also associated, however, with other circles I frequented in Vienna. This was the distinguished scholar of ancient knowledge, Friedrich Eckstein. When I knew him, he did not write much, but what he wrote was full of spirit. Yet, at first, no one would sense from his writings that he was an intimate who knew of the ancient spiritual knowledge. This is active in the background of his spiritual work. Long after life had also parted me from this friend, I found in a collection of writings a very significant presentation by him on the Bohemian Brethren. Eckstein vigorously maintained that esoteric knowledge of spirit should not be made available publicly as we do ordinary knowledge. He is not alone in this view. It was and still is shared by nearly all who have insight into the ancient wisdom. This is a rule strictly enforced by the keepers of the ancient wisdom, and I shall speak later about the extent to which it was breached within the Theosophical Society founded by H. P. Blavatsky. Friedrich Eckstein believed that one who is initiated into ancient knowledge should invest what is said publicly with the power gained from such initiation. Esoteric knowledge itself, however, should be kept strictly apart from exoteric knowledge. That is, esoteric knowledge should be reserved for a limited circle of people who are able to fully understand its value. In order to become active publicly on behalf of spiritual knowledge, I had to make the decision to break with this tradition. I was faced with the conditions of modern spiritual life. In light of these, there was no longer any possibility of keeping matters secret, as they had been as a matter of course in ancient times. The age we live in demands that what is known be made available publicly. The view that such matters must be kept secret is anachronistic. The way for today is to introduce a person to spiritual knowledge in stages, admitting no one to a stage where higher knowledge is imparted before the lower stages are understood. This, in fact, corresponds to the arrangement of higher and lower schools. Furthermore, I was not under any obligation to preserve any secrets. I had taken nothing from the ancient wisdom. My knowledge of the spirit is entirely the result of my own research. But when I have gained some item of knowledge, I relate it to what is already known publicly about ancient knowledge, from one source or another, in order to show that they agree, and to show the progress that is possible for investigation today. Thus, after a certain moment, it was absolutely clear to me that it was right for me to present spiritual knowledge publicly. The end of chapter 60. Chapter 61. On the 150th anniversary of Goethe's birth, August 28, 1898, I intended to publicize the esoteric knowledge living in me. I was motivated to write an article for the title Review on Goethe's fairy tale, titled The Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily. It is true that the article, quote, Goethe's esoteric revelation, unquote, was not very esoteric. But to say more would have required too much of my public. In the deepest sense, the meaning of the fairy tale lived esoterically in my soul. I wrote the article from an esoteric state of mind. Since the 1880s, I had been occupied with imaginations that I experienced as having a connection to the fairy tale. I saw that it presented Goethe's path, from contemplating external nature to the inner nature of the human soul, as he placed it before his spirit, not conceptually, but in pictures. Goethe considered concepts too poor and lifeless to present the life and activity of soul forces. In Schiller's title Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man, Goethe saw an attempt to comprehend the soul's life and activity in conceptual form. Schiller tried to show how the life of the human being is subjected to the necessity of nature through the body, and subjected to the necessity of the spirit through reason. In Schiller's view, the soul must create a balance between these two. In this equilibrium, a person then lives a life that is free and truly human. This is a profound analysis, but far too simple when it comes to actual soul life, where deeply rooted forces flare up into consciousness and then vanish after having affected other equally fleeting forces. These processes are dying away even as they are arising, and abstract concepts are suitable only for comprehending phenomena that have a somewhat longer duration. Goethe sensed the truth of this and placed pictorial knowledge in his fairy tale, as opposed to Schiller's conceptual knowledge. One is at the portal of the esoteric with the experience of what Goethe created in this fairy tale. Count and Countess Brockdorff invited me at this time to give a lecture at one of their weekly meetings. The meetings were attended by people from a wide variety of circles. The lectures were related to every area of knowledge and life. I knew nothing of these events until I was invited to lecture, nor had I heard of the Brockdorffs. I met them there for the first time. It had been suggested that I speak on Nietzsche, which I did. I noticed people among the audience, however, who were very interested in the world of spirit. And when, invited to give a second lecture, I suggested Goethe's esoteric revelation as the subject. And in this lecture, I spoke of the fairy tale from a purely esoteric perspective. This was an important experience for me. I was able to speak with words created directly from the spiritual world. Circumstances in Berlin had thus far limited me to hints about spirit, allowing it only to shine through my presentations. The Brockdorffs were leaders of a branch of the Theosophical Society founded by Blavatsky. Because of my lecture on Goethe's fairy tale, they invited me to present lectures regularly to the members of the Theosophical Society with whom they were connected. I explained that I could speak only of the experiences I had gained through my research in the science of spirit. I could not really speak on anything else. I knew very little of the literature published by the Theosophical Society. I had met Theosophists in Vienna and met others since then. Those acquaintances had been the source of my adverse note in the title Review Concerning Theosophists and a publication by Franz Hartmann. The theosophic literature I had known otherwise was mostly disagreeable to me in method and attitude. It never presented anything I could relate to my own work. I gave the lectures, relating what I said to the mysticism of the Middle Ages. I found a way of expressing the spiritual knowledge I wanted to convey in the views of the mystics from Master Eckhart to Jakob Böhme. Later, I collected these lectures in the book titled Mystics After Modernism. Marie von Sievers came to one of these lectures. She was destined to take a firm hold of the leadership of the German section of the Theosophical Society, which was founded a short while later. It became possible within this section for me to develop my anthroposophic activity before a steadily increasing audience. In the Theosophical Society, there was no lingering doubt that I would present only the results of my own direct spiritual investigations. I stated this fact whenever appropriate. At this point, the Theosophical Society was established in Berlin. Annie Besant was present at this event. At the inaugural meeting, I was elected General Secretary, but I had to leave the event in order to give a lecture to a non-theosophical audience. I spoke to them about the spiritual evolution of humanity, and I specifically added these words to the title of my lecture, quote, An Anthroposophy, unquote. Annie Besant knew very well that I used that term when I spoke about the spiritual world. During a Theosophical Congress in London, one of the leaders told me that my book, titled Mystics After Modernism, contained true theosophy. I was satisfied with this, because my book was solely the result of my own spiritual perception, and this meant that it was acceptable to the Theosophical Society. There was no longer any reason not to present this knowledge of spirit in my way to theosophical audiences, which were at that time the only audiences truly interested in spiritual knowledge. Thus I was not pledged to sectarian dogmas. I was simply one who said what he considered himself entitled to say, according to personal experience of the spirit world. Previous to the establishment of the Theosophical Society's German section, I gave a series of lectures titled From Buddha to Christ, for the coming one's society. In that series, I tried to show the enormous advance indicated by the mystery of Golgotha in relation to the Buddha event, and that human evolution culminates in our endeavor toward the Christ event. I also spoke to this circle of people about the nature of the mysteries. My audience accepted all this. They did not feel that I was contradicting my earlier lectures. But rejection began to arise once the German section of the Theosophical Society was founded, and as a result I was labeled a, quote, theosophist, unquote. It was, in fact, not the meaning of the word itself, but the name and the connection with the society that no one wanted. It was also a fact, however, that the non-theosophical audiences were inclined merely to be stimulated by my lectures and to accept them as literary. There was no understanding for what was most important to me, to introduce impulses into life from the spirit world. I gradually found this understanding in those who were interested in theosophy. I had first spoken to the Brockdorf circle on Nietzsche and then on Goethe's esoteric revelation. Now I gave a lecture on the esoteric nature of Goethe's Faust. This was published later along with my presentations on Goethe's fairy tale. My lectures titled Mystics After Modernism led the same theosophic group to invite me to speak to them again the next winter. At that time I gave the series of lectures that later became the book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact. From the beginning I stressed the importance of the words as mystical fact. My intention was not merely to present the mystical meaning of Christianity. My purpose was to describe evolution from the ancient mysteries to the mystery of Golgotha in a way that would reveal forces active in evolution that were not merely earthly historical forces, but spiritual and extra-earthly. I wanted to show that the meaning presented in the ancient mysteries assumed the form of ritualized images of cosmic processes that were then transferred from the cosmos to earth in the mystery of Golgotha as a sensory perceptible artifact brought about on the level of history. This was not taught anywhere in the Theosophical Society. My stance with this view was directly opposite to that of the Society's dogmas, even before I was invited to be active in it. That invitation came just after I had given the cycle of lectures on Christ. Between my two lecture courses that I gave to the Theosophical Society, Marie von Sievers was at work in a branch of the Society in Bologna, Italy. This was how things developed until 1902, when I attended my first Theosophical Conference in London. At that conference, in which Marie von Sievers also participated, it was already assumed that a German section of the Society would now be established, with me as its general secretary. This was shortly after I had been invited to become a member of the Society. The visit to London was very significant to me. I met important leaders of the Theosophical Society and was privileged to stay at the home of one of them, Bertram Keightley, who became a very good friend. I also met Mr. Mead, a very commendable writer in the Theosophical movement. At the home of Bertram Keightley, the most interesting conversations imaginable took place about the spiritual knowledge alive in the Theosophical Society. With Keightley in particular, those conversations were more intimate. H. P. Blavatsky came to life in these talks. My kind host very vividly described to Marie von Sievers and myself the rich spiritual substance of Blavatsky's personality, to whom he was greatly indebted. I also met Annie Besant, but only in passing. Similarly, I met Sinnott, the author of title Esoteric Buddhism. I did not meet Mr. Leadbeater, but only heard him speak from the platform. He did not particularly impress me. I was deeply stirred by all the interesting things I heard, but they did not influence my own views. While between conference meetings in London, I tried to see as much as possible of the science and art collections. Those collections evoked many ideas in me concerning natural and human evolution. Thus, for me, that visit to London was significant and stimulating. I traveled back to Germany, filled with many different and deeply soul-stirring impressions. The end of chapter 61 and the end of this section of the reading.